Good afternoon, everyone. Always a little nervous when there's no sermonette before I speak, because I think, man, if I came and it was just me, how disappointing that would be if I was out in the audience. But you're already here, so might as well just play it out by ear, I guess. Happy Mother's Day as well. Well, today I'd like to discuss a topic that I'm hoping you probably haven't heard a sermon on in a while. I know when I was preparing this, I hadn't heard one in a while either. And I don't want to give it away just yet, because this is a really interesting topic, at least it was for me. And it's one of those topics that seems very simple on the surface, and in a lot of ways it really is. But it's also one that as you start to dig in a little deeper, you come away thinking just how brilliant God's plan truly is, because of all the nuances and layers that God has as he intertwines principles throughout the whole Bible. And I gave this message up in Northern Virginia about a month or two ago. And even during the preparation, when I was putting it together with Sarah, and we talked about it for so much, and we went through it, and we went back and forth with it, I felt like that even at the end, we were really only starting to scratch the surface, not only about what this topic was, but how to apply it within our lives. But I will say that my viewpoint has definitely changed over the years on it. I grew up in the church. I was born and raised in the church. And this particular doctrine was one of the least important to me, if you could, you know, pick one that is least important. But to be honest, I never really gave it a lot of thought. It was just always something that we kind of did. Now, to some of my kind of casual friends, they just assumed that this was just kind of some Jewishy type thing that our crazy religion did, almost kind of like during the days of unleavened bread when we brought in matzos and crackers, and they thought, well, this is just one of those idiosyncrasies of our religion, and that's something that they did. But to my friends that had a kind of a more detailed understanding about their Christian religion, they always wondered, why would you bother with this belief? They felt like this was really something strange to have to observe this commandment even today. Now, do you have any guesses about what I'm referring to yet? Well, maybe this clue will give it away. In some ways, this doctrinal belief that we hold as a fundamental principle to our faith is actually easier to adhere to in Muslim countries than it is in the Deep South, where everything is cooked in lard. Okay, maybe that gave it away there. Today we're going to talk about the United Church of God's fundamental of belief number 13, and that is clean and unclean meats. And it's a unique doctrine for a handful of reasons, some of which we'll cover today. For example, it's one of those rare doctrines where we have instructions to do, but no explicit instructions as to why. Now, we have some good ideas, of course, which we're going to discuss today, but nowhere in the Bible is there a section that goes through and elaborates why certain animals were considered clean and why certain animals were considered unclean, or why God made the division in the way that he did. Now, we have the commands to observe this law, of course, but there isn't a clear distinction about when this practice first started, or when God originally created this categorization of food. And it's also one of those beliefs, I think, that is met with a lot of widespread ambivalence. Now, some of our beliefs, like thou shalt not murder, I think are kind of universally accepted as pretty good ideas. And And some of our beliefs, though, maybe even like our concept of the family of God, now that might be more hotly contested by other Christians. But if you bring up the food laws, you're most likely to be left with kind of a shrug and a, okay, you know, if that's what you want to do, whatever. But obviously, there is a reason why this is one of our core fundamentals of belief. And that's why we're going to investigate it today. But before we get really started, though, I'd like to lay down some groundwork about this doctrine. I'd like to set the firm foundation and kind of build up from there. So first, I'd like to read the full doctrinal statement from our official UCG Fundamentals of Belief publication. And I want you to brace yourself for the length here. I don't normally like to just read something like this that goes on forever, but I want to go through the whole statement, then come back and break it down from here. Are you ready? So here it is, quote, "We believe that those meats that are designated unclean by God in Leviticus 11 and Deuteronomy 14 are not to be eaten," end quote. It's actually our quickest doctrinal statement that we have. That's not why I picked that today, but it didn't hurt. But don't misunderstand, though. Just because the wording of this statement of belief is short and simple does not mean that the concept behind this doctrine is not rich with meaning and interwoven throughout the whole Bible as a whole. And furthermore, this doctrine really strikes to the core of the type of relationship our Creator wants to have with us. And quite frankly, understanding this doctrine is key if you want to see this relationship God has cultivated throughout time, including with us today. It's so much more important than simply picking and choosing what to have for dinner. Now, we're definitely going to head to Leviticus and Deuteronomy as we go through the message, but the first time this topic of clean and unclean animals is brought up, it's much earlier, as you well know. It's back in Genesis chapter 6. You can turn back there. It's very early in the story of mankind. You can't get much earlier than this. It's back with Noah and the ark, and it's a familiar section of Scripture. But let's still kind of head back there as we lay down some of the groundwork here. We're going to pick it up in Genesis chapter 6, and we'll start in verse 17. Genesis chapter 6, verse 17. It says, "And behold," now this is God giving instructions to Noah here, "and behold, I myself am bringing floodwaters on the earth to destroy from under heaven all flesh, in which is the breath of life. Everything that is on the earth shall die. But I will establish my covenant with you, and you shall go into the ark, you, your sons, your wife, and your sons' wives with you. And of every living thing, of all flesh, you shall bring two of every sort into the ark to keep them alive with you. They shall be male and female." Okay, so far this is very straightforward. This is very practical. God wants Noah to construct this ark for the purposes of saving his family and saving the animals. And I'm not a biologist, but I do know that if you want to save a species of animals, you need at least two. You need a male and female. But let's drop down to chapter 7, verses 1 through 3, because there's a clarification here to the instructions, almost like a little asterisk is added next to the instructions about certain types of animals. Chapter 7, verse 1. Says, Then the Lord said to Noah, "Come into the ark, you and all your household, because I have seen that you are righteous before me in this generation. You shall take with you seven, each of every clean animal." Now, wait a second. What does that mean? "Male and female, two of each of the animals that are unclean, a male and his female. Also seven," we understand that to be seven pairs. "Also seven each of the birds of the air, male and female, to keep the species alive on the face of all the earth. For after seven more days, I will cause it to rain on the earth 40 days and 40 nights. And I will destroy from the face of the earth all living things that I have made." And Noah did according to all the Lord commanded him. Now, nowhere in this story did Noah pull God aside and say, "God, I'm with you 100% here." But what are you talking about, clean and unclean animals? Either Noah already knew what that was, or God had communicated that to him without it being written down in this story. There are obviously practical reasons why more clean animals were taken. They had to eat something, of course, and they were going to be performing sacrifices once they left. Now, where it was revealed to Noah is not known, but by the time we get down to chapter 8 and verse 20, which is after the family and the animals have left the ark and they're back on dry ground, by the time we get to that section, Noah is offering sacrifices, and at that point, it is clear to him what is a clean animal and appropriate for sacrifices and what is not. And this teaching must have continued in some form or fashion after Noah, because all the way until we get to Leviticus 11 and Deuteronomy chapter 14, all mentions of animals for sacrifice or food sources for God's people were animals later explicitly defined as clean. There were goats, cows, sheep, doves, pigeons, etc. So it is clear that there is something here, even though it had not yet clearly been identified what it means. Now, whether God taught Adam back when he was naming the animals, or whether it was first with Noah, the clear guidance of what was to be considered clean and unclean animals was not codified until Leviticus and Deuteronomy, when God had Moses write it down. And in those cases, we really get the nitty-gritty details of what God considers to be the dividing line between clean and unclean. Now let's go back to Deuteronomy chapter 14 and dig in there. Deuteronomy chapter 14. Now, even before we start to dive into the details, I want to really implant a core theme in our minds as we go along. And I'm going to use this reoccurring theme because I think it's important to have the context anytime we go through any list of rules and regulations in the Bible, including those that we're about ready to read with clean and unclean animals. And that theme is this: the Bible is not about rules, it's about relationships. Now, yes, there are rules in the Bible. We're about ready to read a whole bunch of them. The books of Deuteronomy and Leviticus are filled with them. So, of course, there are lots of rules in the Bible, hundreds, thousands of them. But there's much more to the Bible as well. There is stories, poetry, prophecy, there's psalms, there's chapter after chapter of genealogies. There are chapters of buildings and temple details, designs of coverings in priest garments. Now, rules and commands are a core part of the Bible. There's no doubt about that. But that's not the point of the Bible. Instead, the Bible is trying to communicate relationships and relationship principles. Relationships among one another, of course, but chiefly about a relationship with the all-powerful creator of the universe. Because if we approach the Bible as just a set of rules and regulations or a big checklist of do's and don'ts, then it's very easy to get lost in the weeds or to come away thinking that some are just random or arbitrary or that Jesus Christ, when he came in the flesh, just kind of did away with some of them that he thought were old or unneeded, or that he modernized the rule book of life by updating some and casting some aside, etc. But if we come at it from the other approach, that the Bible is about relationships, then we start to think differently about a command when it is given. We start to figure out how that changes or enhances our relationship with God. So does that make sense so far? Hope so. It's with this in mind that we start Deuteronomy chapter 14. And we'll start here in verse 1. Deuteronomy 14 and verse 1. It says, "You are the children of the Lord your God." Again, we're starting with a relationship here. "You are the children of the Lord your God. You shall not cut yourselves or shave the front of your head for the dead." Now, I want to pause here just for a second. And I know what you're thinking, that at this rate, we're never going to talk about clean and unclean animals. But there's a reason why we're building up from this foundation. Because clean and unclean meats isn't an isolated concept that can be taken independently from the rest of the Bible. It can't even be taken independently from the rest of this chapter. Now let's pay attention to the context of where our target section is. We get just a tiny piece of it here in verse 1, and we're definitely going to get more of a sense of it in Leviticus, but this concept of clean and unclean meats wasn't just dropped in randomly. We are seeing hints of it already where God is saying, "Look around you and see how the other nations are doing what they're doing, how they're living their lives, what defines them. Because the way you are going to live and interact with your God isn't going to be like that. Your relationship is going to be different. Now, why? Why is that the case? Verse 2. For you are a holy people to the Lord your God, and the Lord has chosen you to be a people for himself, a special treasure above all the peoples who are on the face of the earth. Now, God is reaching out and he's carving off a group of people that he has chosen. And this group is going to be unique. They're going to act different. They're going to treat others different. They're going to worship different. And they're going to have a unique relationship with their God, unlike any other nation before it, and as an example to all the other nations around it. So when you mourn, you're not going to cut yourself. You're not going to shave the front of your head like they do. In chapter 13, you're going to handle false prophets differently. In chapter 12, your places of worship are going to be different. In chapter 11, how you handle your money is going to be different. In every aspect of your lives, people from around the world will be able to look at you and instantly know you are different. Your relationship with your God, the God, is different. And starting in verse 3 of chapter 14, even how you eat is going to be different. Verse 3, still in chapter 14, you shall not eat any detestable thing. These are the animals which you may eat: the ox, the sheep, the goat, the deer, the gazelle, the roe deer, the wild goat, the mountain goat, the antelope, and the mountain sheep. You may eat every animal with cloven hooves, having the hoofs split into two parts, that chews the cud among the animals. Nevertheless, of those that chew the cud or have cloven hooves, you shall not eat, such as these: the camel, the hare, the rock hyrax, for they chew the cud but do not have cloven hooves. They are unclean to you. Verse 8. Also the swine is unclean for you, because it has cloven hooves, yet it does not chew the cud. You shall not eat their flesh, nor touch their dead carcass. These you may eat of all that are in the waters. You may eat all that have fins and scales. And whatever does not have fins and scales, you shall not eat. It is unclean to you. All clean birds you may eat, but these you shall not eat: the eagle, the vulture, the buzzard, the red kite, the falcon, the kite after their kind, every raven after its kind, the ostrich, the short-eared owl, the seagull, the hawk after their kind. Let's drop down to verse 19 here. Also, every creeping thing that flies is unclean for you. They shall not be eaten. Verse 20, you may eat all the clean birds. Now, there are more details in Leviticus, but the core way to determine clean and unclean foods is here. And it's tempting to read into this list and assign motive to the selections. Like, don't eat pigs because there was no refrigeration back then, and it would have been easier to get parasites from the animal. Or we don't eat shrimp or crabs because they're bottom feeders and nature's garbage disposals, etc. Now, science has definitely proven many health benefits to sticking with the clean animals on this list and abstaining from the unclean animals. But that's not the point. It's not about healthy eating habits. That's like saying that God introduced sexual purity laws so that there would be no venereal diseases. That is an obvious and wonderful benefit to living God's way of life, but that's not the purpose behind these principles. Now let's notice this last verse here, verse 21. You shall not eat anything that dies of itself. You may give it to the alien who is within your gates, that he may eat it, or you may sell it to the foreigner. Now wait a second here. Doesn't God care about the health and the diet of non-Israelites? Well, of course he does. He's not saying, don't eat this, this is going to make you sick, but it's okay to give it to that guy, he's a Canaanite. Well, obviously not. He's not saying that at all. But a healthy diet is not what this core principle is all about. What is the core principle? Well, continued on in this verse, still in verse 21. For you are a holy people to the Lord your God. You are different. God is saying that with his special treasure, he wants to have a special, unique relationship with those Israelites and with us. That he called us out, he set us apart, and is working with us in a unique way. Clean and unclean restrictions speak more about this relationship than it does about diets. God took from the entire animal kingdom that he created, and he carved out a swath of animals. He took those and he separated them from the rest. And every time the Israelites were to meal plan, so to speak, it should have called to their minds this concept of separation. A group of clean animals that has been specifically called out from the rest, and in doing so, having their own minds refreshed that they themselves, as a people, were the same way. A group that has been specifically called out from the rest to have a unique relationship with God. It was a daily reminder. Now, I want to zoom out here just for a couple moments and come at this from a different perspective. And I'd like to turn back to Acts chapter 10. Acts chapter 10. This is a section of scripture that some have used in the past to argue that the food laws no longer apply, that Jesus Christ kind of did away with them after his death and resurrection. But we're going to come at this again from the theme that the Bible is about relationships. And as we just read, when God was working with the Israelites, and as he solidified that covenant with them, he went through a wide variety of principles to show that they were separated from those around them. He gave them all sorts of physical tokens to assist with this spiritual concept. Clean and unclean meats was a way, just one of the many ways, that he wanted them to keep this in their mind, that they were different. So that it was clear that they had this unique and special connection to God. In Acts chapter 10, God was going to work with Peter to help him realize that this relationship, previously one that was more exclusive to Israel, was going to open up. And as a result, many more people were going to have access to a relationship with God that was not previously available to them. Now, if you took this example from Acts out of context, it sure would be an unusual way for God to use this strange metaphor to get his point across. Now, I want to revisit it together. Let's start in verse 1 of Acts chapter 10. Acts chapter 10, verse 1. It says, "There was a certain man in Caesarea called Cornelius, a centurion of what was called the Italian regiment, a devout man, and one who feared God with all his household, who gave alms generously to the poor and prayed to God always." Now, we're going to skip ahead just a little bit in this story, but I think we should understand that this individual was a Gentile, right? I think it's pretty clear he was not an Israelite. Now, that's pretty important to this story. It also seems like he was a pretty good guy here. God hears his prayers, then he tells him to go to Peter. Let's drop down to verse 7 here. Verse 7, still in Acts chapter 10. "And when the angel who spoke to him had departed, Cornelius called two of his household servants and a devout soldier from among those who waited on him continually. So when he had explained all these things to them, he sent them to Joppa." Now here's where the story takes a bit of a turn. Verse 9. "The next day, as they went on their journey and drew near the city, Peter went up on a housetop to pray about the sixth hour." Verse 10. "Then he became very hungry and wanted to eat. But while they made ready, he fell into a trance and saw heaven opened and an object like a great sheet bound at the four corners, descending to him and let down to the earth. In it were all kinds of four-footed animals of the earth, wild beasts, creeping things, and birds of the air." Now, these would have been all unclean animals, as defined in Deuteronomy, as we just read. Verse 13, "And a voice came to him and said, 'Rise, Peter, kill and eat.' But Peter said, 'Not so, Lord. I've never eaten anything common or unclean.'" Now, what a strange metaphor. Now, if you were in Peter's shoes here, you'd have to be taken aback. thinking, why in the world would God want me to change a behavior that is integral to who I am? Peter was observing the dietary restrictions just like every other practicing Jew at that time. He never would have considered eating these other items. Verse 15, and a voice spoke to him again the second time. What God has cleansed, you must not call common. And this was done three times, and the object was taken up into heaven again. So Peter kind of snaps his fingers and he says, got it. Now I can eat anything I want. God has cleaned all animals. Well, no, that's not the conclusion that he came to. Now, Peter had to ponder it for a little bit before he put all the pieces together. But right then, the Gentile man, unclean in Peter's mind, arrives. And God lets Peter know that it was indeed God that sent him. And then it all clicks together, dropping down to verse 34 and 35, as we see it hit Peter, this understanding of a spiritual principle God was trying to communicate. Verse 34, then Peter opened his mouth and said, in truth, I perceive that God shows no partiality, but in every nation, not just Israel anymore, but in every nation, whoever fears him and works righteousness is accepted by him. Now, I've often thought, wouldn't it be a lot easier if God would have just come out and said, you know, Peter, we're working with the disciples now. I've got this guy named Paul. He's doing a pretty good job. So don't worry about it. But I think in thinking that way, it shows just how lower my thoughts are than God. Because by using this analogy, God illustrates a much fuller concept to Peter. Peter would have known at once that the reason some animals were clean or unclean was not because of their physical characteristics, like fins and scales, but because God separated them and designated that they were different. Likewise, the reason the nation of Israel had this access to this special relationship with God was not because of some physical characteristics, but because God himself had carved out these people and designated them as different and holy. So when God tells Peter, I decide what is clean and unclean. I decide who I work with. I decide who I will have a relationship with. It would have made natural sense. Instead of making a statement that clean and unclean animals is no longer important, God is using the importance of clean and unclean animals to illustrate a change in a relationship. If Peter only thought about clean and unclean instructions in Leviticus and Deuteronomy as just arbitrary rules and restrictions, this analogy would have been completely lost on him. Rather, he understood that clean and unclean animals in the context of a relationship God was creating with his people and how, at God's choosing, it could be extended to others as he pleases. Now, I'd like to add on one other principle of clean and unclean animals today, and it's still related to the thread we've been following, but it has its own nuance. And I'd like to head back to the other core area that designates clean and unclean animals in Leviticus chapter 11. You can head back there. There are so many concepts that are interrelated together that we could focus on. The Bible is really unlike any other book, and that the themes are so tightly interwoven and connected together. It's truly remarkable. Now, I'd like to start in Leviticus 11, starting in verse 1. Again, this is the other main section where clean and unclean animals are defined and codified by God. Leviticus 11, again, starting in verse 1, says, now the Lord spoke to Moses and Aaron, saying to them, speak to the children of Israel, saying, these are the animals which you may eat among all the animals that are on the earth. Among the animals, whatever divides the hoof, having cloven hooves, and chews the cud, that you may eat. And the section goes on just like it does in Deuteronomy, and it breaks down the animal's characteristics that can be used in identifying what God has labeled clean and unclean. Cloven hoofs, chews the cud, fins and scales, you know the details. Now, in this section, there are more details than in the other passage. It goes on and talks about insects and the like. But I want to drop down to verse 10. still in Leviticus 11, but dropping down to verse 10. It says, "But all in the seas or in the rivers that do not have fins and scales, all that move in the water, or any living thing is in the water, they are," now get this, "an abomination to you. They shall be an abomination to you. You shall not eat their flesh, but you shall regard their carcasses as an abomination. Whatever in the water does not have fins or scales, that shall be an abomination to you. And these you shall regard as an abomination among the birds, and they shall not be eaten. They are an abomination. The eagle, the vulture, the buzzard." Now, this word abomination is used frequently in this context, and this is serious stuff. And also, what a contrast. Remember that during and after the creation, all of these animals were called good and wonderful. But then all of a sudden, when put in this context of clean and unclean foods, they're looked at in the exact opposite way. These same amazing creatures are now referred to as abominations when used in this way. There are fewer words that are more harsh in the Bible. But it's not just that. In verse 24, we start to pile even more on top and switch from eating simply to touching dead animals and becoming ceremonially unclean. And you'll remember that once someone was ceremonially unclean for whatever reason, they had to remove themselves from the people. Verse 39, let's drop down there. Verse 39, it keeps going and it adds this. It says, "If any animal which you may eat dies, he who touches its carcass shall be unclean until evening." Now, all of a sudden, we've gone from eating principles to cleanliness to even just touching normal things in the wrong way. What does all of this mean? This is a lot of stuff to throw at the reader or the audience when it was written. What is the principle that they are trying to get across? Now remember, we want to filter this by reminding ourselves that the Bible is not designed to be a rules checklist. It has rules, but it's about relationships. So how are all of these separations and distinctions advancing our relationship with God? Let's drop down to verse 44, still in Leviticus 11. Verse 44. "For I am the Lord your God. You shall therefore consecrate yourselves, and you shall be holy, for I am holy. Neither shall you defile yourselves with any creeping thing that creeps on the earth. For I am the Lord who brings you up out of the land of Egypt to be your God. You shall therefore be holy, for I am holy." You shall be holy, for I am holy. Now, like we did earlier, I want to take another opportunity to zoom out just a little bit more, to kind of widen our perspective a little bit on this individual section of the Bible and place it within the context of the rest of the book. The book of Leviticus is all about separations and delineations between things. Over and over again, God demonstrates a spiritual concept of holiness through a physical form of separation. God separates the priests. He ordains them and sets them apart. The first handful of chapters in Leviticus are all about sacrifices and separating of what God has made holy and how the priests are to interact. Just a chapter earlier than what we just read, two of Aaron's sons are killed because they did not take it seriously enough, this separation that God had placed on what was holy, and they defiled it. They treated it as common and not something that is set apart and holy. Now, anyone can combine something, but only God can separate and make something holy. This can be a difficult concept for us to grasp because we have zero experience at making something holy. We can't do that, obviously. So this is a spiritual principle, like so many other spiritual principles in the Bible, that is laid out in physical terms so that's easier for us to understand. For example, Leviticus chapter 23 talks about the Sabbath and the holy days. That's a physical separation of time. Leviticus chapter 27 talks about tithing. That's a physical separation of our money. Chapter 18 talks about sexual conduct and what is separated for the use within marriage. Even little things, like in Leviticus chapter 19 and verses 9 and 10. I'm going to read that out. Leviticus 19, verses 9 and 10. It says this: "When you reap the harvest of your land, you shall not wholly reap the corners of your field, nor shall you gather the gleanings of your harvest. And you shall not glean your vineyard, nor shall you gather every grape of your vineyard. You shall leave them for the poor and the stranger. I am the Lord your God." This is your own land, your own harvest, your own vineyard. But God is again showing a principle of separation, this time with part of your produce for a purpose he determined. This is very important to God, obviously so, since this concept is so thoroughly embedded throughout our Bibles. But yet, how easy is it to forget? How easy is it to take something God has sanctified as holy and treat as common? Now, I think time and time again, when the nation of Israel were going through some list of instructions, and at least in my mind, this is how I visualize it, they're just kind of rolling their eyes and they're saying, yeah, we get it. You know, don't do this, do that, got it. But they didn't get it. It wasn't about the rules. It was about the relationship. And they weren't really grasping how they were to be holy and separated with this special relationship with God. And Leviticus chapter 10, verses 9 through 11, it points out one of the core jobs of the priest was to continually hammer home this principle. Leviticus chapter 10, verses 9 through 11. Leviticus 10, 9 through 11. It says, "Do not drink wine or intoxicating drink, you nor your sons with you, when you go into the tabernacle of meeting." Why? "Lest you die. It shall be a statute forever throughout your generations, that you may distinguish between holy and unholy, between unclean and clean, and that you may teach the children of Israel all the statutes which the Lord has spoken to them by the hand of Moses." Now, instead of working with the people and using these physical examples to demonstrate holy separation, instead they chafed at the rules and restrictions themselves. And as a result, they worked very hard to break down those walls of separation that God had put up because they did not value the relationship. Now, we're not going to turn back there, but remember when Israel badly wanted a king, and they wanted a king just so they could be like all the nations around themselves. And Samuel was so depressed about this. And he went through all the physical things that a king was going to do. He said, you know, they're going to tax you. They're going to take your children for war. They're going to take your crops. They're going to demand tribute, et cetera, et cetera. And he was thinking that they were rejecting his leadership. But remember what God said? He said, "No, Samuel, that's not the point. I separated them. I made them unique. I called them to be my special treasure. I worked to create that relationship with them. They're not rejecting you. They're rejecting me. And they're rejecting that relationship I offered them. They did not want to be a holy nation. They wanted to be a common nation, just like all the other ones around them." And it's not just in that instance, of course, but in so many others, where they took something that God had consecrated, that he set apart and made holy, and they broke it down. They treated the Sabbaths like any other day. They treated the holy days like regular days of the week. They treated the tithes and the offerings just like regular money. It's not that they broke the rules, which they did, but they broke the relationship. They took something that was set apart and holy, and they made common and unclean. Now, Ezekiel summarizes it in a very succinct way in Ezekiel chapter 22. Ezekiel chapter 22, and I like to read this together. We're going to pick it up in verse 23, because this is where Ezekiel really highlights how the leadership was not just wicked and evil, but why they were wicked and evil, and why it caused so much damage. Ezekiel chapter 22, verses 23 through 31. Ezekiel 22, verses starting in verse 23. It says, "And the word of the Lord came to me, saying, Son of man, say to her, you are a land that is not cleansed or rained on in the day of indignation. The conspiracy of her prophets in her midst is like a roaring lion tearing the prey. They have devoured people. They have taken treasure and precious things. They have made many widows in her midst." Notice this next verse, verse 26. "Her priests have violated my law and profaned my holy things." How do they do this? "They have not distinguished between the holy and unholy, nor have they made known the difference between the unclean and the clean. And they have hidden their eyes from my Sabbaths, so that I am profaned among them. Her princes are her princes in her midst are like wolves tearing the prey to shed blood, to destroy people, and to get dishonest gain. Her prophets plastered them with untempered mortar, seeing false visions and lies for them, saying, Thus says the Lord God, when the Lord had not spoken. The people of the land have used oppressions, committed robbery, and mistreated the poor and needy, and they wrongfully opposed the stranger. So, verse 30, so I sought for a man among them who would make a wall and stand in the gap before me on behalf of the land, that I should not destroy it, but I found no one. Therefore, I have poured out my indignation on them. I have consumed them with the fire of my wrath, and I have recompensed their deeds on their own heads. Thus says the Lord God." The leadership mixed everything together. They removed the separation. Nothing was holy. It was every man for themselves. They took the carefully crafted principles that God designed for his people, his own special treasure, and cast it aside. And when they moved away from what God had made holy and what God had made clean, then trouble soon quickly followed. Now God sought a man to make a wall, it said, to stand in the gap. A wall is for separation, to keep the outside out and the inside safe. But God couldn't find anyone to uphold the separation between the unholy and the holy, the clean and the unclean. Now, holiness is such a difficult concept for us to wrap our minds around. That's why it's so important for the leadership to take these physical examples that they were given and use it to help illustrate a spiritual relationship concept to the people. And once they failed with the physical, of course, the spiritual failed soon after. Well, what about us? Can we still use the physical separation that God has laid out for us to better understand this concept of holiness? And can we integrate that into our own relationship with God? I mean, after all, we are His special treasure as well, are we not? Well, in conclusion, I want to turn back to 1 Peter chapter 2. I want to read verses 1 through 10. And I wanted to close with this passage because it sums up the doctrine in a way that I was really hoping to get across. And actually, it doesn't mention clean and unclean foods even once. But yet, it has everything to do with the principles that clean and unclean foods was designed to illustrate. 1 Peter chapter 2. Starting in verse 1. 1 Peter 2, starting in verse 1. "Therefore, laying aside all malice, all deceit, hypocrisy, envy, and all evil speaking, as newborn babies, desire the pure milk of the word, that you may grow thereby. If indeed you have tasted that the Lord is gracious, coming to him as to a living stone, rejected indeed by men, but chosen by God, and precious. You also, as living stones, are being built up a spiritual house, a holy priesthood, to offer up spiritual sacrifices acceptable to God through Jesus Christ. Therefore, it is also contained in the scripture, "Behold, I lay in Zion a chief cornerstone, elect, precious, and he who believes on him will by no means be put to shame. Therefore, to you who believe, he is precious. But to those who are disobedient, the stone which the builders rejected has become a chief cornerstone, and a stone of stumbling, and a rock of offense. They stumbled, being disobedient to the word, to which they were also appointed. But you are a chosen generation, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, his own special people, that you may proclaim the praises of him who called you out of darkness into his marvelous light, who once were not a people, but are now the people of God, who had not obtained mercy, but now have obtained mercy." God looked out across his animal kingdom at all the animals that he had created, and he carved out and he took a subset of them. He did so to designate some clean and the rest unclean. And he told the Israelites that every day when you're thinking about what you're going to eat, remember this separation as an illustration of the relationship God wants to have with you. And just as God separated out these animals and made them unique as a physical reminder of a spiritual concept, likewise, he carved out a little group of people from among the great nations of the world and set them apart. He wanted them to be holy, an example for all those around him. He wanted to have a unique relationship with his special people. And when God opened up this special relationship to all mankind, the parties of the relationship may have changed, but the type of relationship that God wanted to have did not. Instead of a physical nation called to be separate and unique as a special treasure and a model to the world around, we now have a spiritual family, still called and separate as a unique special treasure to the world around. We are unique and different than all those around us. At least we should be. We are to model the perfect example of Jesus Christ as a light on the hill. And if we start to forget what it means to be a true Christian, called and separated, we have many, many physical examples we can lean on, be it with the Sabbath, with separated time, be it with tithing, with separated money, and be it with clean and unclean animals, with separated food. Well, next time you come across an unclean screech owl or a vulture on a buffet line, just walk right on past. Now you can go to the desserts and take an extra scooping of locust if you want. Those are clean. And then when you leave that restaurant, maybe take a note of where you went, because that's a strange restaurant to be sure. But most importantly of all, let the principles of clean and unclean animals guide not our meals only, but every step and every action we take as we grow in our relationship with God.